We want to take a look at what David did immediately following his sin with Bathsheba, and we have that recorded for us in Psalm 32. Immediately following the sin with Bathsheba, David, for almost 1 year period of time, refuses to acknowledge and confess his sin. And if you notice, Psalm 32 is called a Psalm of David, and then you have the word maskil. Maskil is very simply an untranslated Hebrew word that means insight. And it means insight in two senses of the word. First of all, it means this is a psalm that has insight. And second, it means this is a psalm that gives insight. Obviously, of course, if it has insight, it also is able to impart it. So it is an insight psalm, or what we sometimes call a doctrinal psalm, in that it teaches and expresses a major doctrine or doctrines. There are 13 maskils in the book of Psalms, giving wisdom. I'll not write them out, but I'll simply list them. They are Psalm 32, Psalm 42. In each one of these, you want to ask, what is the insight that the psalm is trying to give me? What is the doctrine? What is the truth it is attempting to teach? 32, 42, 44, and 45. And then you have a little cluster of 52 through 55 are all maskil. Then 74 and 78. And then two together, 88 and 9. And 142. 142, 88 and 89, 78, 74, 52 through 55, 45, 44, 42, 32. And they're all in this particular category. And therefore, whenever we see any of those psalms, we'll want to ask, of course, what is the teaching and the insight that is offered? The teaching offered by Psalm 32 is the doctrine of the salvation, the discipline, the confession, and the restoration of a believer. And if we would outline it briefly to start, the salvation of the psalmist is stated in Psalm 32, 1 and 2. We will be able to establish that verses 1 and 2 are simply saying David was a saved man. And I'll show you why we can say that and why that is a doctrine taught in just a moment. Second, and in verses 3 and 4, you have the doctrine of the discipline of a believer. So the discipline of David is 3 and 4. And third, and in verse 5, you have the confession of David. And that's really in 5a, that's very brief. And then God responds to it immediately by the fourth part of the psalm, which is the restoration of the psalmist. And the restoration is in 5b through verse 7. And then finally, to end up the whole thing, the psalmist, having taught these doctrines, will then exhort on them. And so you have exhortation, which is in verses 8 down to the end of the psalm, verse 11. Now, when you look at that, it is very obvious that a great deal of insight is here. He's going to say, you may be a saved man, but upon sin, if there is no confession, there will be discipline. And once the confession is made, there will be instantaneous restoration. And then he gets exhortation and application out of all of that. So we're looking at the insight, or we're going to get insight concerning the salvation, discipline, confession, and restoration of God's child. All right, first of all, we have something about the salvation of David, and that is found in 32, 1 and 2. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. And we'll want to ask the question, how do we know that that is referring to his salvation? How do we know that that means he's a saved man? How do we know that he's not talking about just a Christian who has just sinned and is forgiven? How do we know that? Well, we'll show you in a minute. Whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity. Imputation is a doctrine connected with what? The Christian life or salvation initially? Imputation is connected with justification, isn't it? Imputation means God puts righteousness on our account. So you have a doctrine there of imputation. and in whose spirit there is no guile. Now, the reason we know that these two verses refer to salvation is because of Romans 4, 1 through 9. And let's go to that for a second just to establish the point that he is no doubt talking about his salvation. That's what these first verses are saying. Romans 4, 1 through 9. If you can recall way, way, way back, the subject matter of Romans 4 is how to get justified, or how to be saved, or how to get a standing with God. And he begins by taking two passages. First of all, he goes back to the life of Abraham and establishes how he got saved. Verse 1, what shall we say then that Abraham our father, as pertaining to the flesh, has discovered? For if Abraham were justified by works, notice this is talking about becoming a Christian, justified by works, he have whereof to glory but not before God. For what says the Scripture? Quote, Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed God, and it was imputed. Doctrine of imputation. Imputed unto him for righteousness. Imputed means he got righteousness put on his account. Now a conclusion to him that works is the reward. That is, what is the reward in context? To him that works, the reward for his faith back in verse 3 was righteousness. So if we can do it by works, then the reward or righteousness is not a matter of grace, but a matter of what is owed us. Then comes to a conclusion again, and notice in verse 6, he gives the second illustration of a saved man. And he gets the doctrine of imputation right out of Psalm 32. It says, even as David, well, let's read 5. But to him that works not, but believes on him that justifies, notice we're talking about salvation, the ungodly, his faith is imputed for righteousness, even as David. Now he's going to talk about imputation from David's writings. Even as David also describes the blessedness of the man unto whom the Lord imputeth righteousness without works, saying, quote, Psalm 32, 1 and 2, blessed are they whose iniquities are forgiven, whose sins are covered, blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin. What did he leave out of Psalm 32? Did you notice he left out an item? He left out the last part of verse 2, which says, in whose spirit is no guile. Why? Is a spirit having no guile a condition of salvation? Or does that describe a Christian? That describes a Christian. And notice Paul wisely in teaching the concept of justification, when there are four items listed in Psalm 32, he only lists the three that pertain to salvation there. So we know beyond any question then that this is talking about his salvation. Now let's go back to it and look at some of the items. Each of the first two verses begin in the same way. Each of the first two lines in the Hebrew Bible beginning with the word blessed, like that. So that if you look at the structure of the psalm, you'd see line 1, blessed, and then it continues. Then line 2, blessed, and it continues. So right up front, you have the word blessed, and we need to say a couple of things about the word. In the first place, the meaning of the word blessed, ashar, means to go straight. Now think for just a moment. How in the world could the word meaning to go straight also mean blessed? The word blessed in the sense of being happy. How could they translate a word going straight to mean happiness? Any connection? Very simply, in the Old Testament, the only way to be blessed was to go straight. And consequently, the very words themselves, if you go straight, you're blessed. That's just an axiomatic thing. So to go straight is the condition. It's a basic meaning word, the condition of happiness. That wouldn't make a popular bumper sticker today. Happiness is going straight. You would be called square. Okay. The second thing we ought to say about the word blessed is that the word in both of these words are plural. And the idea of a plural in Hebrew is the idea, in many cases, of intensity. So we would start in verse 1. Intensely happy is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Intensely happy is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity. Then notice in the following context, he gives some of the items about forgiveness. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. Transgression is an interesting expression that occurs hundreds and hundreds of times in the Old Testament. And it simply means a breach in a relationship. Interestingly enough, transgression is only tied to man. God doesn't breach relationships. And basically, whenever you have transgression, there are only two options on God's part. Either punishment of the transgressor or renewal of the transgressor are the two options always there. Then notice, continuing on, it says that his sin is forgiven. The sin being forgiven, the word for forgiven, very, very popular Old Testament word, nasa, means to lift. His transgression is lifted up, and his sin is covered. Why would he say that his sin is covered? For a simple reason. God forgave sin in the Old Testament, did he not? Did he have a valid basis for forgiving sin in the Old Testament? The answer to that's no, isn't it? Can God forgive sin apart from the death of Christ? Isn't that the basis? How could he forgive sin in the Old Testament then? Well, we often put it is that God took the sin in the Old Testament, covered it up, and when Christ died on the cross, took the covers off and put it on him. Or sometimes it said in the Old Testament, you were saved on credit. In other words, God anticipated. And in fact, part of the book of Hebrews says one thing about the cross of Christ is it declares that God was righteous when he forgave sin in the Old Testament. Have you ever stopped to think that if you stop your Bible, as the Jew does, with the Old Testament, you have a crooked God? Because you can establish from the Old Testament that he forgave men their sins. Where were they adequately paid for if you're not going to move to the cross? So if you're not going to move on to the cross work of Christ, how do you explain God's being just and forgiving sins in the Old Testament? And the answer is, of course, you cannot. You have to have Christ for that fulfillment. So to covered or hidden in the sense that they would be later dealt with, and then the man to whom God does not impute iniquity, of course, is the doctrine of imputation. So we're coming on then. In the first two verses, David was a saved man. When he committed adultery with Bathsheba then, what kind of man are we dealing with? A saved man. He had salvation. He did not lose his salvation through his sin, but he, at that point, faces us with the reality of a carnal Christian. And therefore, that moves us into, number two, the discipline of the psalmist, or of David, verses 3 and 4. Now, notice in the verses that follow, verse 3 and 4, you have two psychological factors. Number one, it says, when I kept silence. And so factor number one is suppression of a guilty conscience. David suppressed his conscience, and you have this remark about remaining silent, suppression of a guilty conscience. So instead of, as a believer, immediately confessing his sin, he did not do that. He suppressed it. And he suppressed it for a period of about 1 year. He would not deal with it. He would not face it. He would not confess it. He suppressed it. And as we said this morning, one of the results in the human standpoint of the suppression of it was, remember when Nathan came and told him the story that applied to David? David didn't even see it. And therefore, when we suppress a guilty conscience, we become insensitive to sin. Will ensue. And the second thing that is going to occur was not given back in the book of Samuel, as we studied this morning, but the second thing that comes about here with this, well, I'm going to put it down as number two. Let's just leave number this way. Suppression of a guilty conscience or insensitivity to sin. The second thing that comes out in these verses is the psalmist stresses the psychosomatic effect of the suppressed conscience, the psychosomatic effect. And notice that's given from the standpoint of look at what it did to his body. Psychosomatic simply means that the body is suffering because of something in the mind. And in this case, he refused to confess sin. He pushed it back. He suppressed it. And it showed up in his blood pressure, and it showed up in his headaches, and it showed up in his collapsing physical type thing. And very, very important, therefore, from a Christian standpoint, to say that when we suppress the conscience as a believer and refuse to deal with and confess sin, then God has a built-in system. He's going to make us sick so he can make us well. In other words, there is a built-in thing between the suppressed conscience and the psychosomatic effect of it. And notice it's very clearly psychosomatic. Verse 3. When I kept silence, my bones, that refers to the body, my whole frame, physical body, grew old. It's used of something wearing out through my roaring all day long. And notice the emphasis is there is a link between the suppressed guilty conscience and the condition of the body. This aged David. Notice also in the psalm, is this really a psychological problem? Is he going to deal with it that way? Is he going to say, I was emotionally and psychologically and mentally ill for a period of time, and that's what caused the psychosomatic thing? David is going to go to two things. If you have a person who has a psychosomatic illness, you name to me any doctor that I know of that will say the problem behind the psychosomatic illness is A, sin, B, negative volition toward the Word of God. You ever heard a psychiatrist, psychologist say that? Well, notice that David is going to do that in the context. Down at verse 5. I acknowledged my sin to you. Notice the difference in volition between verses 3. Verse 3, he kept silence. He suppressed. Verse 5, he acknowledged. Positive volition. And of course, it was due to sin. So we have a link then that goes something like this. You have the suppression of the conscience up here at the top. That results in bodily deterioration. He's growing old. And behind all of that was sin and negative volition. This is the root that men so often will not face. Okay, now let's go to the text. That is a really encouraging thing. It's an encouraging thing. To me, it's discouraging if, you know, you've got these psychosomatic problems and we can trace them back to your childhood and it was the way you're raised and so forth. Until you almost get to the thing, poor me, I'm a real victim. This viewpoint says we're not victims. David did something to get there, and David can do something to get out of it. And therefore, when we realize that so much of our problems can be not, again, don't misunderstand, if you've got a headache, does not mean you're out of fellowship with the Lord. It just means this is a possibility, and that the body cannot handle a suppressed guilty conscience effectively. Okay, now notice the setting for the discipline. Coming back to verse 3. First of all, we've got the setting for discipline. In the words of verse 3, when I kept silence. Let's put it this way. The discipline, why it was, and we've got that in the words, when I kept silence. Then the discipline, what it was. Notice it was bodily. And third, we'll look at in verse 4 where it came from. But at this point, he simply says, when I kept silence, and I like the way the Hebrew lexicon reads on that word, charesh in Hebrew, it says, to be dumb, to be without speech. And the idea is, as far as he was concerned in talking to God, he was just like a dumb person. And in terms of his communication with the Lord, he was absolutely speechless. He said nothing. He sinned, and he lived with it. And he was in that condition for 1 year. Then notice the reference to his bones. My bones waxed old. Actually, it's the word bone in the singular, which means, in the plural, rather, which means bodily frame. And I think New American's given you bodily frame, has it not? Or my body. Okay, body. My body. The point is to note that this is physical. Something is happening to him physically. My body waxed old. That's worth looking at that word because it's colorful. It means to wear out. For example, look at Deuteronomy 8:4 just for an interesting picture. Deuteronomy 8:4. God has told how he brought Israel through the wilderness and how he took care of them. And we're looking at the word here. It says, your garments did not wax old. You know what an old worn-out shirt is like? Well, David picks that word and says, when I suppressed the guilty conscience for 1 year, at the end of it, I was like a worn-out shirt. Another interesting expression of that is in Genesis 18:12. I'm just trying to give some color to the word, how his bodily functions, how he wore out. Sarah is told that she's going to conceive and have a child, and in verse 12, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, am I waxed old? After I'm waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also, and waxed old the same way. I'm worn out. I can't have children. I am worn out. And David is saying the same thing then about himself in Psalm 32. When I kept silence, my body wore out. Through my roaring, the word roaring is used of anybody in distress. It's the same word that's used of Christ on the cross in Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from the my words of my roaring? And so it's a roar or that comes or a moan that comes out of a distress. So he's in distress, and this again is all day long. All right, now notice one other little expression, and that tells us where this came from, why it was suppressed conscience, no confession, what it was psychosomatic, bodily, and third, where it came from. And that's in verse 4. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My moisture, Hebrew word is a word for juice. My juices, and it was often used for your vitality, for your energy. My energy, and again, we're still in the physical realm now. My energy, my bodily energy, my vitality to function in life is turned into the drought of summer. And so the idea is that God's discipline was to David like the lack of water is to the ground. And living in an area where they were so dependent upon the water, you can see the parched dry ground, and that was the way David's body was becoming because of what? Mental attitude that suppressed the guilt. Okay? Now that moves us then to third, the confession. And we're into a year now. David has been holding out, and now we have confession. First of all, this is one of the good passages to tell us the nature of confession. The reason it tells us, is a good one to tell us the nature of confession, is because in the poetry of the psalm, you have the parallelism. Remember, in Hebrew poetry, and again, all of the book of Psalms is poetry, you have not rhyme of sound. You don't have Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, everywhere Mary went the lamb was sure to go, where you have the rhyme of sound. Parallelism is rhyme of meaning, not sound. And that's part of the genius of Hebrew poetry, rhyme of meaning. And what that means then, can you give me four lines using different words saying the same thing? The meaning of line 1 matches the meaning of line 2, and the meaning of line 2 matches the meaning of line 3, and so forth. Now, why is that psychosomatic? Why would that be good for instruction? Parallelism repeats. In teaching, don't you sometimes find that you say something and you draw a blank? And you say, okay, maybe I could say it this way. And you try that, and you say, no, you don't get it. Well, would this illustration help you? In other words, you repeat saying a thing different ways. And therefore, in the third verse, or rather in the fifth verse, we're going to get three parallels, so that if you don't understand one, they'll explain one another. And notice what they are. Verse 5, what's he do with his sin? Number 1, I acknowledged my sin. That's the first line. The second one is, my iniquity, I have not hid. So the second line, I have not hid sin. And the third is, I will confess my sin. So notice, if we miss the idea of what confession is, all this relates to is sin, that we've got it said three ways, so that if we miss all three, I suppose we're hopeless. But notice the first one is, I acknowledge. And notice, by the way, does David in verse 5 see what the real issue is? Does he know why his body's falling apart? Does he know what's going on, or is he not aware of this? Sure, he's aware of it, and he is aware of it in the sense that it's sin. As a matter of fact, if you were looking at a Hebrew Bible in verse 5, it would be striking, because the first thing would point you, the first word you would hit would be, guess what? My sin. So right up at verse 5, he's talking about, I suppressed my conscience, it's killing me physically, and the issue is my sin was not confessed. So notice the ideas. First of all, the idea of acknowledging sin is a Hebrew word that means simply to make known. Now, it's not that God didn't. I think acknowledged is too much the idea of admit. I acknowledge does not mean I admit. It means I taught God something. Of course, David could not teach God anything, but it means the idea that here's something that someone does not know about, and I'm going to inform you. So you could say, I informed God about my sin, and again, not in the sense that God does not already know, but God needs to be told and wants to be told about these things, and that's found in the word acknowledge. Straightforwardness is the idea. Second, when he says, my sin I have not covered, the word sin again comes first, and this is a sense often used, the word for hide is often used for ignore, ignoring something in the Old Testament, in the sense that it's not there. So what is confessing sin? It's teaching God about what we've done. It is explaining, making it known to him. Hit it another way. Do it negatively. What is confession of sin? Well, it's not ignoring it. And David ignored it for a year's time, and David was disciplined for that ignoring the sin. Then finally, you have the word confession itself down in the fifth verse, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. And then notice you have an immediate response on the part of God. Notice how short the confession section is. We're now down to restoration. And notice that our first point is, as far as the restoration, is the stress is it was immediate. There was no waiting around. There was nothing about, are you really sorry, David? It was immediate confession. Now, the way we can get that, and it's interesting the way the Hebrew Bible puts it, see the word thou, forgavest? That's a separate pronoun and therefore an emphatic one. So I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord and you. So immediately God responds. So it was immediate, and that personal pronoun points out it was personal. God gave him a personal and an immediate response. And in the restoration dealt with the real issue. God did not deal with the bodily problem. God dealt with the real issue. You forgave the iniquity of my sin. Now, notice we come in verse 5 to the first S-E-L-A-H. And the word probably means lift up. It's a musical notation is the idea that's involved in that. And so you would look at the psalm from the standpoint of he's trying by the musical background to get across the message. And he gets a message which is his salvation, or no, which is his discipline. And notice that ends with verse 4. And then you have Selah, which we would translate as forte. And then you come down to the end of verse 5 after the confession. and you have another forte. And then you come to the end of verse 7, which marks off the exhortation part, and that's your final forte. So the idea would be, you can hear the orchestra lightly in the background as he says, blessed is he whose transgression is covered, and so forth and so forth. And then when I kept silence, and so forth, day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My moisture, vitality was turned into the drought of summer. Ta-da! And then what do we have? I acknowledge my sin, and you forgave my sin. And then the orchestra lifts it up one more at the end of verse 5, and then you have another one at the end of verse 7. And so they're fortes stepping up to a musical type thing. And why do you think God would want something like these things put to song? Simply because the song is such an aid to memory. You ever get to hear in a commercial that you advertise for them all day long? You can't get that song out of their mind, and that's what he wants to do, was to enforce psalms by means of music. Now, let me ask a question or two. Number one, in verses 1 through 4, do you think David was aware of his sin? Or do you think he pushed it in the background and did not know? Was he failing to confess knowingly? Was he being stubborn? And I think our answer for that goes to Psalm 51. And verse 3. Which reads, and again, it's still in the context of the sin with Bathsheba, and we know that because of the inspired title up there that puts it in the proper place. And he says in verse 3, I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. So David is simply saying, looking back on that, from the day he did he have a guilty conscience? Sure he did. Did he know he was sinning? Yes, he did. Why then would he refuse to confess sin? Well, why do we refuse very often to face and deal with sin? This is his protracted carnality, and this is what calls for the discipline. All right, now coming out of the restoration and so forth of David, we now have the concepts that flow from that, and let's simply call them confession, restoration, concepts. And the first thing we've got is the lesson to be learned from it. And that's in verse 6. For this, and what does the this refer to? It points back to what has gone on in the particular context. It points back to what David has learned. This is the point in the psalm that's going to instruct us and teach us. For this shall every one that is godly pray to thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Now, first of all, the word godly, it's an important word. It's a word, Old Testament word for grace. For this shall every one that has been graced, or experienced grace, pray unto thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Now, is that saying that there's a time when when God can't be found? When God's going to say, too late, you can't find me now. No, I would relate the time relative to the discipline. And he's saying to be smart and instead of do what I did and delay and keep silence, confess before the time of discipline comes. Further support for that is the expression in verse 6, the flood of great waters. Flood of great waters is inevitably used for God's discipline and sometimes for God's judgment. So the idea is, immediate confession. Don't wait like I did. Then you have the statement in verse 7. First of all, the lesson. And the lesson is confess immediately. Do it before the waters come. Do it before God floods you with discipline. Then second is a stress on the relief that comes from the confession, and that's in verse 7. And notice what follows in the relief. The first thing, thou art my hiding place, The relief is, number one, in the area of personal fellowship with God, is restored. Personal fellowship restored is the first point. And that's found in the idea of thou art my hiding place. Also, verse 7 starts with a personal pronoun. You personally are my hiding place. Thou shalt preserve me from trouble. What else? What other kind of relief does he get? He gets a restoration of self-confidence. He's not worried about his enemies. Why? Because he's restored to fellowship. Third, you have in 7 also, and you will preserve me from trouble. You have a new protection erected now that the sin is confessed and forgiven. See the relief? Personal fellowship with God is back. His self-confidence is restored, and a brand new protection from his enemies is involved. And then finally, you get a new mental attitude, and the new mental attitude is back to joy again. I will instruct, or the last part of verse 7, you shall surround me about with songs of deliverance. Now, with that, he then turns and says, let me give you some exhortation. In other words, this is what the psalm ought to mean to us and how we ought to apply it in verses 11. Now, first of all, when you come to verse 8, you've got a little problem. Who's talking? Is David talking or is God talking? Who is the I in verse 8? I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way that thou shalt go. Is this David or God? And if you try and get the answer, you find out it doesn't make any difference. Because if this is David speaking, who else is speaking? Under the doctrine of inspiration, God is also speaking. So, strictly an academic question, and I take it that we would take it in the direct sense that we have the promise of God to teach us. So the exhortation would be simply this. After confession, dash, restoration, we can again be taught. God cannot teach where there is unconfessed sin. We can be taught again. And that's part of the promise that's involved. Taught, that's an interesting word. It's actually the word taught and also the word instruct. I will instruct thee is the word we're going to have in Proverbs. I'll make you skillful. I'll give you sense and wisdom in life. But that follows the confession, which is in verse 8. Then notice in verse 9, part of his exhortation is going to be a focus on the suppressed conscience. Verse 9. And you have a very colorful type thing. Now, if you have King James, you have something like this. Be not as the horse or as the mule, who have no understanding, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle, lest they come near thee. And that's a strange thing. What's the idea of putting the bridle on to keep the horse from coming to you? The point of the bridle and bit is what? To make the horse go with you. And if you have, you should have something like this in verse 9. Let me read it. Do not be as the horse and the mule that have no understanding, whose mouth, whose ornaments are, whose ornaments or trappings are bit and bridle to restrain them, or they won't come near you. In other words, the idea is the bit and the bridle is what makes the horse come along. And therefore, he's introducing an illustration and says there is a parallel between the carnal believer who will not confess the sin and a mule. Now, what do you think might be the parallel that he's drawing between the two? I would take it, first of all, that the mule has no common sense. Parallel, the carnal believer who refuses to confess sin has no common sense. And number two, the bit and bridle, is that they will not follow willingly. Will not follow without restraint of some kind. Why do you put a leash on the dog? because if you don't have a leash on the dog and go for a walk, he'll run into traffic or run away or something of that sort, and therefore the leash on the dog illustrates it. Perhaps if David had known cats better, you can't put a leash on a cat because they will not follow anything that they do not wish. And consequently, you have a parallel between these two that he's making very, very strong here, which, again, is attributing animal-like conduct to the carnal believer. So that focuses in verse 9 on the suppressed conscience. The bitten bridle of verse 9 is parallel to the discipline of verses 3 and 4. See, the psychosomatic problem is God's way of saying, I want your attention. Why do you think God made it that when there is a guilty, suppressed conscience, that you have psychosomatic or physical repercussions? Why did God make it that way? Well, we ought to look at it from his perspective. He's trying to get our attention. He's trying to say, I can tell you where the tension's coming from. I'm going to let you feel it in your body. And then finally, you have in verses 10 and 11 the conclusion, and he makes a doctrinal observation here. Many sorrows are to the wicked, but he that is good, notice, is it between a contrast between the wicked and the good? What's the contrast? Between the wicked and the believing. Interesting contrast, is it not? Simply because many of those that are believing are also sinners, are all also sinners, and therefore the contrast is many sorrows shall be to the wicked, the unbeliever, but he that believes in the Lord, mercy shall encompass him about. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous, and shout for joy, all you that are upright in heart. So notice you have a very clear maskil. Is there any doctrine that a believer ought to know any better than, look, when you're saved, God's righteousness is imputed to you. That's fundamental. That is basic. That's doctrine. And that's verses 1 and 2. When we sin, if we keep silence and do not confess, there will be discipline, and the discipline will show up in psychosomatic ways. The minute, however, sin is confessed, there is instantaneous restoration. And out of that instruction, therefore, comes the idea of don't be like the mule. Don't do that. Don't cut off God's ability to teach you by carnality, which David did for 1 year. So the Psalms, again, I think, as we look at the life of David, become so much more meaningful than they were previously. I don't know what your experience has been, but going through the life of David, I keep going back to certain psalms, and I can say, oh, I see why he wrote that now. I can understand that kind of feeling that David had, and I think it's important to put them both together. Okay, we're going to take a closing prayer, take about a 10-minute break, and then we have the Moody film at 7. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. We're thankful for the doctrine that is taught to us in this psalm through the life of David. May we recognize that grace and forgiveness is always immediately available, and may we recognize through the testimony of David the misery we can bring on ourselves when we will not handle these issues. And therefore, may we be as honest as he was and not say it's our background or there was some reason why we couldn't handle this thing. May we recognize that basically our problems are sin and negative volition to your word. May we learn from this in Christ's name.